trying to stir away from the idealist approach and draw attention to this pragmatic relationships that exist in conflict context where full peace agreements are not implemented.
This is Richard Long. Welcome to this podcast on peace and conflict resolution. Our goal is to share ideas, insights, and practical approaches that encourage deeper exploration of peace building in action. Today's episode focuses on the 2025 book, Functional Coexistence in Socio-Political Conflict, edited by Toshi Arya. Tosh, as he is known, is a faculty member at the Kent State University, and Marguerite Tadasvanya are both graduates of the Jimmy and Rosalind Carter School for Peace and Conflict Resolution at George Mason University. Marguerite Tadasvanya, Executive Director of the Center for Peacemaking Practice at the Carter School. Her work bridges theory and practice with a focus on local peacebuilding effectiveness and the role of evidence in peacebuilding work. In this conversation, we'll explore one of the book's four central themes, the concept of minimal, livable social space. What is the why of this book? What brought you to put so much time, energy, and intellectual power to this?
We're drawing attention to the pragmatism of peacebuilding interventions. We're trying to stir away from the idealist approach and draw attention to this pragmatic relationships that exist in conflict context where full peace agreements are not implemented, but there people find ways to develop relationships that are functioning enough to provide space for further social change potentially to emerge. And another element that we're emphasizing, that we're not trying to be prescriptive, we're not necessarily suggesting that functional coexistence will eventually absolutely lead to the desired social change. What we are trying to show by examining all the different case studies is that there are places, contexts, environments where functional coexistence provides the space where things happen and potentially after long-term engagement, they can provide for enabling conditions that can eventually lead to the social change.
What are those, generally speaking, enabling conditions?
That's a good question. And the answer would be that it depends on the context. Every context, those enabling conditions are different. And what theory of functional coexistence and functional coexistence approach is telling us or helping us to be aware is to develop historical awareness of changing acceptable conflict behavior that changes things. And I'll give it, I also authored the case study in Turkey in the book, and within that context I can say that things that were unimaginable 25, 30 years ago in that context become possible now. And the behavior, both on the political level, but also on like a human kind of interaction level that was seen impossible years ago, we see that now. And it is the importance of this kind of the functional coexistence theory, what it helps us to understand that we have to not look at isolated incidents that are happening or actions that are being taken, but to develop this macro historical awareness and put all these different episodes that happen on a continuum and zoom out and look at this historically changing boundaries of conflict, acceptable conflict behavior.
Is it possible to help people to see this as a dynamic relationship that you're talking about and not get anchored in the Armenian genocide
that happened over 100 years ago. It's still real in family lore. How do you get beyond things like that?
Obviously, generational trauma, historical trauma, memory, those are real for people in given context. Mm-hmm. And we should not devalue their significance and the impact and the symbolic value that it has for people who have gone through those traumatic events. No one is denying the fact of the Armenian Genocide. In my chapter, I say that clearly. It is part of the historical narrative, but also part of the history of the country. At the same time, we see, and it is important to recognize the changes that have happened both within the Armenian society and political establishment, as well as the changes that are happening on the Turkish side. No one, when I was a young girl studying in Armenia public school, it was not imaginable that at some point we will have the Turkish intellectual elite organizing I apologize campaign and accepting the fact of genocide. Obviously, that was not at the state level, but even the intellectual kind of groups previously were not part of the conversation. So having developing awareness about those changes and then shifting or adapting your approach. Again, a colleague of mine, incredible organization that does work in Armenia, they have published stories about how ordinary Turkish families were helping Armenian families to escape genocide. And those are the stories that are usually get lost or silenced in more kind of traumatic and more aggressive, let's say, narratives. But again, having the ability to develop that awareness, things change. Now there is much more informal and sometimes even formal trade between Armenia and Turkey. There are a lot of like tourist exchange, again, a little bit disproportionate. Armenians go to Turkey for vacation or trade much more than the other way around, but those things happen. In the past 5 years, I've learned about at least four of my friends who got married to Turkish men or women, which was unimaginable, again, when I was growing up. So those things help us to zoom back from this very small, concentrated trauma narrative and see how things can change. But also that change happens at different levels. It happens at the political level. The devastating earthquake that took lives of so many people created an unprecedented opportunity. The border that was sealed closed for 30 years opened for the humanitarian aid from Armenia to Turkey. About that, 2 weeks ago, the Armenian Prime Minister invited Turkish journalists from all the news outlets and major news outlets in Turkey to Armenia to talk about and give exclusive interviews and tour them around Armenia and show them and talk about the issues. That never happened before. So those are the things, again, we can debate if it's a good thing, if we have a good government, those are beyond the point, but it is the importance of what was unacceptable before becomes possible now and what it can lead to. I think, again, different conflict contexts are different, but I think we're all, in a way, human beings that are seeking stability, functionality, ability to go about our lives without fear of prosecution, fear of being killed, and uncertainty. Again, the key element in the functional coexistence theory, as suggested by Dr. Araya, is the idea of minimally livable social space. We can talk about functional coexistence only when people have this minimal livable social space where their basic human needs are met. There is no debilitating asymmetry of power. So let's say in case of like enslavement, that's impossible. In case of imprisonment, that like you have very symmetry in power. So the ability of actors both as countries, but also at the community and individual level, to maintain certain level of agency.
That concept of the minimal living space, several chapters, one of the things I really enjoyed about the volume was how there were links between various chapters. It weren't just the summary chapters and the opening chapters, but rather that you as coordinators, not much more than editors, brought these links together. But I didn't fully understand, was the minimal living space concept, is that's has a physical element to it to some degree, but also a metaphysical element to it.
We're not only talking about physical security, but also discursive space where people are able to function, have their basic human needs met. And again, the theory of basic human needs, that's not only the physiological needs, but also our ability to practice our religion, our ability to get education, to have like self-actualize, and all those kind of elements. So within the sense where when we're talking about MLSS or MILIS, how we abbreviate it, it's about both, as you said, physical and non-physical, where human interaction, everyday interaction happens and provides the actors with a sense of some sort of fulfillment and some sort of sense that they are able to function without interference.
Or is this just an analytic tool?
So I would argue that it's both. From a kind of practitioner perspective, I want to say that conflict resolution and peace building sometimes or oftentimes gets the bad name because there isn't this expectation that it's some type of a magic tool. Social change, especially after violent conflicts and prolonged violent conflicts, is difficult. It takes years and decades for people to bounce back from atrocities and from devastation of the war and any other violence. And within the conflict resolution theory, when Galtung has developed this kind of concept of negative and positive peace, and when positive peace encompasses the social justice and absence of structural violence and cultural violence and everything, it's not only absence of negative physical violence. We all took that as our North Star, guiding star, right? And we aspire to build positive peace. And we assume that negative peace is not good enough. And I think we very clearly said in the opening chapters of the book that we do agree that we always need to aim for the positive peace, for just society, for everyone being able to have dignified existence free of violence and any repressions. However, functional coexistence emphasizes the pragmatism of negative peace and the importance of that state of absence of violence to continue to engage. A lot of times what we see, especially from the policymakers and funders, when the negative peace is established and then you're working on again, like moving beyond that, it's a very long process. And interest is being lost. Results are very slow and minuscule at points. And people don't want to pay attention to it anymore. And here we're trying to say long-term engagement matters. It is about decades long of engagement, not like parachuting in and out where you can see the change. And negative peace has tremendous value in helping us to build up potentially to a point of positive peace. So it is trying to, in a way, to reverse the negative emphasis that we have on negative peace. We're not glorifying negative peace. We're not saying it's a good thing, but we're saying it is absolutely necessary and good enough foundation for us to continue to be engaged.
Your opening chapters very directly make the statement that positive peace is better One of the things I did take from your volume, though, was that negative peace is a continuum by itself, and that gives you opportunity to apply and at least find some sort of balance so that people can live.
Exactly. I think you said it very right. It is a continuum. So again, going back to the, and unfortunately it can also go in either direction.
Right.
If we go back to the case of Armenia, Turkey, for example, the negative peace that we have now is much better than negative peace in 1990.
Right.
So we have come a long way. We're getting away from very raw version of negative peace, just absence of violence. Now we have a much substance in our interactions and more depth and more nuances and more dimensions, right? But on the other hand, if we go to Armenia, Azerbaijan case, 10 years ago, we had a better negative peace. We have no peace now. So
right.
Again, and we can talk and theorize why it all happened and so on and so forth. But again, you're absolutely right. It's about negative peace is not one type. And you can have much better negative peace, and you have to work towards building that.
How do you give tools in this environment, where the wounds are deep, people are at razor's edge sometimes, and sometimes even expecting the other side to do something wrong, even when it's just a mistake?
It's a very difficult question, because we all know it's one thing to manage a relationship between two people, but then when the group gets bigger, it is no longer the sum of X amount of people in that group. So it develops a life, a mentality, a dynamic of its own. And I feel we see that at the society level in a very, like everything on steroids way. And especially if the society has gone through trauma and has specific triggers. I think that coming back and when things happen, we tend to focus on that immediate occurrence or the immediate event. And I think the functional coexistence approach that offers us to zoom back and look historically on a continuum, where it fits, what came before it, what can potentially come after that, helps us to be less stuck in actual event. And we still need to process it. You cannot, again, like, it, you need to process that, but not get precisely stuck on the particular. You put that on a continuum of things that happen, and to try and understand what can be the next.
It's almost that you're outlining in putting history in historical context. You can apply the same set of understandings to an immediate what would have been a triggering event. And in a sense, you apply what you've learned for something far away to something that's close.
Yes, but also there are four kind of guideposts that we've developed, I think, in the book. And I'm going to mention in this context two of them. One is that when crisis happens, when things happen, we tend to try to immediately find a solution. And what functional coexistence theory tells us is we need to try to resist premature solutions. And again, it is a delicate balance of like how we can end human suffering. But again, rushing, I'm going to come back and say with the Armenia-Azerbaijan example, there is this peace treaty that is happening. There is this big push for signing a piece of paper. But we have to ask ourselves if it's a rushed solution, how we can continue to constructively be engaged in a state of non-resolution. We're not resolving the conflict, but we are working out a space where we can hash out our differences instead of putting something very quickly on a paper that is not going to hold up.
That doesn't reflect the dynamic relationships.
But at the same time, we have to also try and balance the inertia of things that are happening and resist the hegemonic stability. So in that sense, we should not get comfortable in what was the default for many years. One of my colleagues, he said it once, and I don't know if he knows how profoundly it stuck with me, the thing that he said, we use the term reconciliation, which linguistically implied that there was a prior state of conciliation that now we're trying to reconcile.
Right.
We need to understand that we are, and he then moved to another analogy, it said like the, with the Humpty Dumpty, we're trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together. We might not need to put Humpty Dumpty together. Humpty Dumpty at that point what got into this whole situation. How can we imagine we can build with what we have instead of recreating? So there is this always this implied recreation of what was before. But that's not potentially what we need to be doing. Suppose we are like trying to not rush into preemptive solutions that are not ready, but at the same time, we should not be getting comfortable in this stability and situation, or imagined stability.
This has been fascinating. And where do you want this book to go? Who do you want to read it?
I would want students, master students, undergraduate too, students and scholars also to read this. I feel that the diversity of the cases that we have from different parts of the world, from Cambodia to Northern Ireland, offers people interested in even world history a different perspective on some of these parts of the world. From growing up in a conflict country, Northern Ireland was always like, and we always very often treated as a poster child, see how peace is built there. But then Roger McGuinty offers such a nuance about what's happening in Northern Ireland. And it's not as functional as we think, and it is functional for someone, but completely dysfunctional for others. So that, and we should not treat this as the echelon, and this is what we have to strive for, because it, even in the Northern Ireland countries, it is something to improve. Very long time in Armenia, we're thinking with Nagorno-Karabakh, if we get to the status of Cyprus, that's good enough. That's like, it, they're semi-recognized, or like the Northern Cyprus and the Cyprus. But then you look at the life and challenges and daily struggles that people have in Northern Cyprus and Cyprus, you understand that it's not as glorified as it can be. So it offers a perspective to students and whoever works in the spaces. But I want to say that mostly I think it would be eye-opening and in a way educational for policymakers and to funders and people working on evaluating peace-building projects to read this, because it offers nuanced perspective of what progress looks like and how measurements are done in this. It's very difficult to measure the effectiveness of peace building projects when we are talking about 6 months, 2 year, 1 year intervention. Things change. We see that in this country as well. We see it everywhere in the world. So I feel that the having read the book, people will, in policymaking world, in peace, in funding world, will also get a fresh perspective of what decades-long engagements look like and what evaluative tools can be applied to this type of engagements to see the value at the core and to understand that the funding that you put into this is not lost. It's actually making a change. It's just how we see that change and how we conceptualize that change.
You and your colleagues are providing us with not a roadmap, that would lead to failure, but rather a process and that people can look at and understand that their strengths and weaknesses, their different histories, their different techniques, their different meanings of words that can be applied in these very difficult situations with the hope of making a contribution to improve people's lives. Thank you.
Thank you again for spending time with us. And I would like to thank our guests for sharing their insights and information. To get a copy of Functional Coexistence in Social Political Conflict, Enabling Social Change Across the Decades, you may find this book on Open Access, which has been provided by the publisher Routledge through their Taylor and Francis group.